Hey, I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Mission Matters. My name is Adam Torres, and if you'd like to apply to be a guest on the show, just head on over to missionmatters.com and click on Be Our Guest to apply. All right, so today I have Michael Levine on the line. He's founder of The Activist Investor. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you so very much.
All right, Mike, so we got a lot to talk about today. So we're going to talk about, of course, activist investing today and tomorrow. We're going to talk about the Activist Investor Conference 2024. First thing, I guess, just to get us kicked off, I swear when I saw a founder of the Activist Investor, I was like, wait a minute, did he found the conference? Or like, where's the play? I know Charlie and his team over there have been working on the Activist Investor Conference 2024. I guess just to kick us off, like, how did you connect with Charlie and like, how did that take place?
I've been in activist investing for well over 20 years, and I also have a newsletter and some things I send out to try to help elevate the level of knowledge and discourse in this community. Mm-hmm. And they found me. They said, we're thinking of creating a conference that will address some of the really, you know, key issues that are being talked about, which I'm sure we'll cover today. Would you be willing to help us structure that? So I gave them some comments about that. And then they said, we have some room for on the panel. Would you like to be a speaker? I said, sure. So that's later on in March in New York City. So I'll be there.
Yeah, that's a lot. Are you out of New York by any chance? Or?
No, I live and work in Chicago.
Oh, okay. Midwesterner. I'm a Midwesterner too. Live and work out of L.A., but I'm from Michigan. So love my Midwest.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. I want to go further back. You've been activist investing in this, even this concept. I mean, as you know, it gets more and more play in the news now, but you said you've been in this game for, you know, 20 years plus. Like how'd you get attracted to this?
Well, I was both as an investor and as a finance executive with a couple of places. Then also I was a management consultant with some big firms for many years. I grew frustrated with how companies change, how big public companies or even medium and small public companies, you know, sometimes there's a notable lack of urgency or a complacency or a willingness to focus only on what they want rather than what investors want. And I decided to try to do something about that. So I started with some of my own personal investments where I was an activist and tried to urge companies to change in certain directions, and then also became an advisor to other investors, hedge funds, family offices, and so forth that have similar problems. And so, you know, between some of my own portfolio and then advising others, it's been very busy and fulfilling.
Mm. Now, in the beginning, I want to stay in the early days a little longer because, you know, there'll be some people listening to this that have ideas and they're going, I would argue, and back then you were going against the grain. Like, I don't think or you correct me if I'm wrong, was everybody like, oh, wow, that's a great niche for you to go in, Mike? You
draw your No.
Is that how it happened?
No, you're absolutely right. This is at a time when, you know, Carl Icahn, who we read about these days a little bit, was just going crazy trying to make change at companies. And was really finding not only opposition from the boards of directors and the executive teams, but also from other shareholders. He couldn't get a meeting with any major mutual fund or institutional investor at that point. Since then, you know, while there's still some pushback from the companies, from the boards and the leadership teams, there's a much wider acceptance of this investing method, this investing approach among institutions, which is important. You know, the big three, which is BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, you know, they have at least embraced this a lot more. They're much more willing to, you know, push back on a company, you know, based on stuff they're seeing. So early on, it was hard to get the message across, but it's somewhat easier these days, I would say.
Yeah. What kept you strong in the early days, like to your, whether it's your thesis or however you want to explain your values, your core, like what kept you strong and like, no, this is where I'm going. Like what did it for you?
I knew I was right.
Ooh, that's a good one.
In my heart of hearts and intellectually, I had a very good point to make that public companies have a responsibility to shareholders, to big mutual funds and little individual investors on Robinhood that own, you know, a few shares. And they need to be pushed. They need to be motivated in the right way to represent all shareholder interests much more diligently than they might be doing.
Mm. How do you define activist investor? Like, how do you define that?
An activist investor is one who does not like passively just invest and then sort of see how the investment goes. They interact constructively with the board of directors and the management team. They are not hesitant to share ideas about what a company should be doing, and the management team might not always agree that that's the right direction for a company. But they first have the creativity and the ambition to want to make sure the company is on the right track. But they also have the determination and the will to escalate, to try to put pressure on a company, pressure from other shareholders, pressure from regulators, pressure sometimes even, sad to say, from litigation, to try to compel companies to do this. It's a combination of being willing to work with companies, but then I said also willing to escalate these situations when companies aren't necessarily being as responsive as shareholders might like.
Mm. Can you give me an example of that? And I'll tell you, and it could be from past, it could be a famous thing we all know, it could be something we don't know, something you worked on, something you didn't, but I just want to put a little bit of, you know, flesh around that for our audience.
Absolutely. One I worked on where I was on the board of directors of a consumer electronics company in Southern California for several years was a situation where the board was really just not, and it was called Comarca was the name of the company. It's no longer around. The board just refused to have any kind of serious goals or, you know, pressure on the CEO and the management team to try to perform, to try to find new markets, to try to defend intellectual property and so forth. And so a bunch of investors and me were able to go in, and we got ourselves elected to the board, changed management around, and kept the company going for a lot longer than people thought was possible. Another more current example is fascinating. It's fascinating to everybody, you know, only aficionados at this point, but it's a fascinating situation if you're following what's going on at Disney. And Disney and an investment company called Trian Partners, whose head is a guy by the name of Nelson Peltz, have disagreed about the path that Disney should take. And Peltz has decided that he and another distinguished, as it turns out, former Disney executive should be on the board, that that's the best way to try to guide or even put some pressure on current CEO Bob Iger. So everyone's watching that situation very closely to kind of see how it works out. You know, Disney shares are down a lot over the past few years, and Peltz has some ideas. As I said, ideas is the first ingredient here, some ideas for what the company needs to do. And he's also willing to put some of his own effort and time and money behind trying to, you know, get proper board representation to make sure that those ideas are taken seriously.
Wow, that is interesting. Because that could, if, I mean, let's just play, you know, play with this one for a moment. If that does happen, like what kind of precedent with a company as big as Disney and someone's able to make that kind of play, like that sets a whole new precedent for what's possible.
That would be pretty amazing, especially if you know Disney pretty well. You know, Iger has a very distinguished record of success there. He acquired Marvel. He developed, you know, ESPN. He did a lot of really good things. But some of his most recent ideas and so forth, particularly the acquisition of Fox, haven't necessarily worked out as well as investors would have liked. But nonetheless, he has a significant amount of support from the board of directors. The board of directors has really mostly just refused to put any kind of pressure, put any kind of goals on him. They just really, you know, the sentiment among investors, shareholders, is that the board's basically let Iger kind of do what he wants. And, you know, that worked out for a long time, and then it didn't. So investors like Peltz, and there's others, there's a whole community of us that do this, are willing to try to shake things up in a way that, you know, may be uncomfortable for boards, may be uncomfortable for guys like Bob Iger, but in the end are, you know, have investor interests at heart. So, yeah.
Yeah. Talk to me about Tesla. Talk to me about Tesla and corporate governance. Yeah.
Tesla, you know, we had
to bring that one up.
Oh my God. Tesla is just a fascinating situation. You know, Tesla is one of the best examples of bad governance around, and Tesla's starting to pay for it. I actually was involved in one of these. A shareholder, a pension fund, litigated against the board of directors to try to get some of their compensation back. You know, boards of directors get paid for what they do, and the Tesla board got paid very, very well for a number of years. And this shareholder decided to push back on that through litigation in Delaware, which is their corporate domicile. And I contributed to that a little bit with trying to make sure that the settlement represented, you know, shareholder interests well. At the same time, a different shareholder in another situation sued the company because of CEO Elon Musk's compensation. And that was the one we read about in the past few weeks where the judge in Delaware decided that the shareholder was in fact correct, that Elon Musk had to give essentially give back about $55 billion with a B worth of shares of Tesla back to the company. There's going to be all sorts of appeals and so forth. But where it stands right now is that the, you know, a significant amount of CEO Musk's compensation is going to have to be given back to the company. Now, what ties these two together and a number of other things that people have seen with Tesla is the board of directors. The board of directors at Tesla is essentially handpicked by Elon Musk. You know, we could kind of look at some of the legality, some of the regulation and so forth, and some of the disclosures. But, you know, once you get past some of the formalities, every director on the board of directors at Tesla has a very close relationship with the CEO, you know, starting, of course, with his brother, Kimball, but, you know, going on to a bunch of other directors. That's really not healthy for a company. You need some distance. You need some sort of independence. Not just on paper, but kind of intellectually and spiritually, from especially from a CEO such as Musk, who is such a strong character with so many resources and so many ideas. So, you know, Tesla's kind of, you know, getting to an inflection point here. You know, competition's ramping up in its core businesses. Some of its other ventures are starting to try to pan out. And so the board's going to have to really provide some direction and boundaries and guardrails for a guy like Musk. And that's hard. You know, I don't envy those directors.
I don't either.
To try to stand up.
I don't either. I don't either, Mike.
It's something that, you know, there's a lot of Tesla shares. You know, Tesla is one of the most widely held shares among individual investors. And everybody's counting on that board to hold, you know, Musk's feet to the fire and make sure he's focusing on what's best for Tesla, not what's best for Elon and some of his other ventures. That's a summary of what's going on at Tesla. It's a much, much larger story than that, too, but that's kind of the highlights.
Any other significant activist investing situations you're following in 2024?
There's a biggie that's going on out there that could be very groundbreaking, and it's the one at Starbucks. And, of course, Starbucks is in the news because of its labor relations and so forth. You know, lots of stores trying to unionize and so on. And just this week, there was some announcement that maybe Starbucks is willing to negotiate a little more with some of the union, the SEIU union. What's less known is SEIU took another path toward trying to put pressure on Starbucks. SEIU nominated three candidates to the Starbucks board of directors. And it's three distinguished labor relations people in the U.S., you know, more, shall we say, a little liberal leaning, you know, more supportive of, you know, union rights and so forth. Anyway, but the SEIU nominated these three people. They're trying to place basically union appointed or union supported directors on the Starbucks board. It's not clear how it's going to work out. There's a little bit of thinking that maybe these effort to put these candidates on the board of directors representing labor, in fact, helped Starbucks want to restart negotiations this week. Now, it's not quite clear. No one's really saying. But that's going to be one of the first examples of these, you know, cause-related or ESG investors really going as far as trying to put directors on a company board in order to help make their case. So that's another one that at least, you know, activist investors are following really closely to sort of see how that works out. And we'll know what happens there in the next 2-3 weeks. The Starbucks annual shareholder meeting is going to be, I think, March 13th. So so a Starbucks shareholder should be voting on that right now.
Man, Mike, so going back to, you know, where it started for you 20 years ago today, did you foresee things, not with Tesla or a specific company, but did you foresee things like this happening in the future? Like,
no.
Is this part of your original thesis of this could happen in your wildest
dreams? Not quite. You know, a lot of good things have happened for investors, for shareholders in that time period. You know, there have been some regulatory changes that have made life easier. There's just sort of attitudinal changes where the idea of of interacting with companies in this way is just much more accepted.
Or even ESG, you know, like even just ESG, even the fact that we use that term, was, right? Yeah, and no that one, there's...
no one had even put those letters together. 20,
exactly.
20 but yeah, so it's really come along.
So where do you think it goes from here?
Well, there's going to be a couple trends. This ESG trend, we'll see what happens with Starbucks. But mm-hmm. this ESG trend could get some traction mm-hmm. where lots of other people who are interested in climate, in mm-hmm. civil rights and so forth may find it attractive to try to interact with companies in the way that the SEIU is now trying to do that with Starbucks. Another interesting trend is going to be the increasing power over these situations that individual retail investors have. You know, right now, for a while, it was, you know, the big three that we call them, BlackRock, Vanguard, yep. and State Street, they cast a lot of the votes. They're starting to turn a lot of that voting responsibility over to their individual investors. So people with even, you know, small accounts with just a few mm-hmm. number of shares are going to find they're increasingly empowered to matter in these situations. And there's a lot of attention that people are starting to pay to how can we get the attention of these retail investors in ways that, you know, help, you know, all the whole investor community. So, yeah. Mm.
I'm just thinking of the logistics of that. That'd be interesting. Like just to see on the back end. Like, and by the way, I don't think you know this about me, but so, I mean, I worked for Vanguard for many years and I was in finance almost 14 years. So I'm just thinking about the logistics on the back end. But with technology now, I mean, you're not mailing out per se necessarily. I'm not going to say that actually, because I don't know, maybe you still have to mail, but I'm just fantasizing about the day when, you know, if they can shift some of that responsibility over to the investors and they get an email or they get something else or whatever their secure portal is. And then you get to read yourself and then be a part of that. It becomes almost like an extension of civic engagement. I think it's a wonderful trend.
There's a lot of financial technology that's starting to grow up around this that's trying to make it easier for all investors, including retail investors, to do this. You're right. It used to be you'd get this big volume of mail sometime in April and May.
Man, huge. And you'd be like,
which proxy card, which color. It used to be a mess. It's a lot more streamlined now, and it's getting even better as these different financial fintech apps start to take hold. So yeah, so it's not where we'd like it to be, but it's certainly a lot better than it was even a few years ago.
Amazing. What are you going to be? I don't know if I covered this yet. What are some of the topics and some of the things you'll be expecting to cover at the conference coming up?
We've covered some of it. You know, again, conferences like this are for pros who spend their life in this kind of world. So there's some technical subjects about how company bylaws are changing. There's a mm-hmm. bunch of lawyers that'll be talking about developments in the state of Delaware, which is where a lot of these companies do their work. You know, again, the retail investor situation. I'm being interviewed by a prominent reporter just about what's happened in the past, you know, 5-10 years in activism and what we can expect in the next 5 or 10 years. So I'm taking good notes on our conversation here too. I'll just say some of that stuff again. But yes, it's a full day conference with some really interesting subjects. So it should be pretty fun.
Fantastic. Well, Mike, really appreciate you coming on the show today and sharing some of your insights and also history. And I love the fact that you said, I'm telling you that, you know, 20 years ago, you're like, what kept me strong? I knew I was right. I knew there was a better way.
Right.
I knew. And so to stick with an idea, a thesis, and to, you know, work the way that you have over that, I think it's a great model. So thank you again for coming on the show. If people want to follow up and they want to continue to follow your work, Mike, how do they do that?
Couple things. You can sign up for the email newsletters and so forth at the Activist Investor website, which is theactivistinvestor.com. The Activist Investor, one word, no punctuation. And I also have a pretty active Twitter feed at the Activist Investor. You can find me either place. That's a good way to follow what I'm up to.
Fantastic. And to the audience, if this is your first time with Mission Matters, the links to that will be in the show notes, but also hit that subscribe button. If you need a special invitation, that was yours. Hit the subscribe button. And if you're a long-term listener and long-time listener and you haven't left a review yet, definitely leave that review. We sure do appreciate it. And Mike, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Hope I answered everyone's questions today.